we face this fact then that society is very much interested in this subject, and needless to say, the individual is too. And the values of a culture oftentimes then will reveal themselves in their valuations of sex and sexual intercourse and human relationships in general. Now, about 5 or 6 years ago, a man named Isidore Rubin made a study of the value systems engaged, the sexual and value systems, and he says there are 6 of them, and he says they're in conflict with one another. And he began, let me just spread out this continuum before you. One, we have a traditional repressive asceticism. And he says this is the official view, and this is the one that condemns sex outside of marriage and tolerates it, I use that word underlined, and only tolerates it within marriage. Then he says there is a second view, one step up, and he calls this enlightened asceticism. And he says this is the view followed by men like David Mace. And he says that sex is good as long as you place it within controls. And then the next is humanistic liberalism. You forget the titles, try and remember some of the thought. And that is the value is not in sexual acts per se, but in the relationships within which they're carried on. And the exponent is Kirkendall from Oregon. Then radicalism, all sex expression is good, especially adolescent sex expression. Codes must be modified. We must make it possible for any kind of sex expression at any time, and without young people as they grow up feeling guilty about this. Then you have the fun morality. This is espoused by Albert Ellis and Hugh Hefner in Playboy magazine. And finally, sexual anarchy, which is René Guillon, who says simply, the only restriction on sexual activity is that you don't hurt somebody. Otherwise, it's anything goes at any time with anyone concerned. Okay, now where do you start? Because really, you have to end up on this continuum someplace. Either you have to say sex is rigidly encased in a relationship and can only be tolerated there. In fact, it's not a very good thing. Or it is simply something that calls for no restrictions. And we have to find our place there. And the reason we do, and the reason we can't ignore an opinion about sex, is that this is the way in which we were brought into existence. Every one of us here is here because of a sexual act by our parents in which conception took place. And this means that if sex expression is so potent, if it is capable of actually bringing about the creation of a human personality, a human being, then it is something that is prima facie so important that it simply can't be ignored. And any thinking person can't treat it lightly. And this is where I have some real problems with people who have adopted essentially the purely hedonistic attitude that the sex is for fun, period, because there's so much more to it than simply that. Would you get the door open and close it? Consequently, we can't respond or regard sexual intercourse as insignificant. In fact, our evaluation, your evaluation of sex may really reflect your evaluation of man, and may even go so far as to reflect how you think about yourself as a person, and as a personality. Now, for many years, the Christian church said simply, sexual intercourse is for reproduction, period. And they did this on the basis of what they thought was the scripture, but it wasn't the scripture, it was really St. Augustine. And St. Augustine was a man who lived in North Africa, who was a very intelligent man. He was not a Christian. He was married. He also had a mistress, and he loved the mistress very much. And upon his conversion, well, his conversion came about in this way. He was in his mother's garden, and this was separated from a neighbor's garden by a high wall. And the other side of the wall, there were some children that were playing, and they were singing a little ditty which went like this, take and read, take and read. And so with this sing-songing through his mind, he went into his mother's house, and there was a copy, a scroll of the scriptures, and he picked it up, took it up and read it, and he opened it up to a verse which went something like this, and put on the Lord Jesus Christ, and do not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. And it seemed to Augustine that this was like David's little stone. It hit him right between the forehead, or right in the forehead between the eyes. And shortly after this, with this as at least a partial impetus, he became an open confessing Christian. At the time that he did, he gave up his mistress, and he gave up sexual pleasure, and somehow the two then, this loss, became part of what he had gained. And so to him then, moving into the Christian life, or the expression of the Christian life, mean that you denigrated sexual expression, put it down, and gave it a far lesser place than it might have deserved. It isn't really until almost into the 1800s before you find someone in the church putting in a good word for sex. Luther said, well, you know, it's a good physical thing for the body, and therefore this should be taken care of. But there was no strong, real pat on the back until finally a man named Jeremy Taylor says, well, it does ease the cares and burdens of, you know, of the household, which was really not a strong endorsement either when you read it over. But at least it was the first one spoken by a clergyman who said a good word about sex. Now, you see, sexual activity is life authenticated. Where do we normally live? We live in cities that have macadam streets and concrete sidewalks and plastic fronts and brick walls and polished wood. All the things that are natural are covered up or are not there. We live in a make-believe or a made world. And in the midst of this, you find this one experience which still can take people back in a very strong and elemental way back to nature. So when I say sexual intercourse is life authenticating, I mean it makes people feel alive. Also, it's one other area in which there can still be competition. People can compete for one another. In other areas, competition is almost out. You fill out the form, you punch the computer, you wait and see what happens. But here there is still a chance for competition and for conquest. And finally, it's a renewing experience. Sexual intercourse need not be old hat, the same old thing. It has a way, at least it has the possibility within it for being creative, for being renewing, for making this experience almost as if it were the only experience. Now, I'd like to give you four sort of viewpoints, and we can pick up a discussion from there. Sex is a phenomenon of nature and of culture. Nature, simply because we are bodies. Physiologically, we are male or female. Physiologically, there are very few barriers to keep almost any man and any woman from engaging in intercourse. And so people don't have to be concerned about how big they are, how little they are, what their backgrounds may be, or anything else. In terms of just the construction of our sexual natures, our sexual bodies, there are no problems there. But there are some real differences in culture. Now, nature provides sex, and culture provides love. And Theodore Reich has written in his little book, or his big book of Love and Lust, made some very fine and interesting distinctions between these two. He says, for instance, sex is located in the genitals. Love is located, well, it's just where? If it's not in the heart, it's certainly not in the organic heart, but we speak of it as located in the heart or in the person. It's not located in a part of the body. Sex, he says, is interested in the self, myself, my needs. Love, on the other hand, is unselfish. It is interested in another self. Sex is highly non-selective. It says anybody will do, anybody will do, any woman will do. Love, on the other hand, is highly selective. It says, I want this woman. I want my relationship to be with that man and not any other. Sex can be very casual. Love can only be very personal. Sex is a strong interest in another body. Love is a strong interest in another person. Love focuses on satisfaction. I mean, if sex focuses on satisfaction, love focuses on happiness. And then he finally concludes, look, you can force someone to enter into sex with you. You cannot force anyone to enter into a love relationship with you. And I think I've always appreciated this distinction, and I think it has an innate quality that gives it its own value. Okay, so you begin then by saying that sex has a lot to do with the physical body. It has a lot to do also with our culture. Secondly, sex is a source of pleasure. Now, there are four physical pleasures, or four sources of physical pleasure. One is the cessation of pain. You know, you hit yourself and it's so good when it stops hurting. The second one is the process of physical elimination. The third is the satisfaction of hunger and thirst. And the fourth is the pleasure of sex. Now, the church has, well, all through the years, well, the church said officially, now sex is for reproduction, and certainly there must be no pleasure involved in this, yet I suspect that there was a great deal of pleasure involved in it anyway. And there's an old English proverb which expresses this quite well. It says, sex is the poor man's leg of mutton. Sometimes, I think today, sex is valued oftentimes because it's forbidden. Theodore Wright's observation about our own culture, our own very sensate culture, focusing on feelings and this kind of thing, he says that the phrase, to have fun in America, is becoming almost equated with the idea of having sexual expression. Pleasure can be a natural corollary of individualism. We live in a time when people are very individualistically concerned, the individualistically oriented. People move into marriage today in what we call the companionship or the companionate marriage. This is the idea of, I am a personality, I would like to share life with you as a personality in order that I may grow and that you may grow. There's a great deal of pursuit of life, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But oftentimes you find that it's my life people are interested in, and my liberty, and my happiness. It's my rights that are concerned, you see. It's my business that we're interested in. And even though sex is a shared expression, I am primarily interested in what I may receive out of this, not of yours. And if there's a total emphasis on this, it means then that even if two parties were each sexually satisfied in an encounter, nevertheless it could still be a selfish, an exploitative act on the part of each one of them, if there was no love involved, which involves an interest in the other person as a person. Now, we have some strong exponents of the idea of a hedonistic evaluation of sex. Albert Ellis is a New York psychologist. He has written in the field of what he calls rational therapy. He really has a very good thing going there. It is a type of form of therapy which is very good. But at the same time, he is pretty much an anarchist when it comes to sex. He says the only rule is don't exploit, but you can do whatever you want to. In a world that is dull and drab as the one that we live in, if a person can find a little sexual fun, I'll let him do so. The only reason that adultery is wrong is because we call it wrong. If we didn't say adultery is wrong, people would engage in adultery with very few bad consequences. We find the same viewpoint, or we find a parallel viewpoint to express somewhat in Hugh Hefner's Playboy philosophy, in which a woman is pretty much an object rather than a person. She may be an object, she may be an ornament, she may at times be a trophy. I remember a young man who stopped to see me after a class I was teaching, and we started talking about his desire to date and ultimately to marry. He was not a very handsome guy by any definition. So but it was interesting, he started to talk about his ideal girl, you know, the girl he really would like to date. She would be a beautiful figure and face. She would have long blonde hair. She's the kind who would drive a convertible, and she would whip along the ocean down by the California beaches. And if she felt like it, she'd slew over to the stop and kick off her sandals and run down to the ocean and run up and down on the edge of the, you know, the surf rolling in on the sand. And she would be a magnificent dancer, and she would be, you know, a good dresser. And then Carl says, and then I said, Carl, then you can just see yourself, can't you, coming in to a room with this girl on your arm and having all the fellows saying, gee, where do you suppose Carl got that? And he said, yeah. And I said, you know, Carl, you're not talking about this woman as a person. You're talking about her as a trophy. You know, look at that beautiful elephant head on the wall. Tell us how you got that. So, well, the expedition, you know, 60 days into darkest Africa, well, it would have taken Carl some over 60 days to get this kind of a trophy, but he was willing to try. The problem here, you see, is that the playmate, you know, in the center of Playboy does not exist. They do not make girls with staples in their bellies. It's done with a machine, and it's also done with a hairbrush. That's being displayed. It's really not a mate. And you can consider yourself, you see, involved with this girl in your imagination, but you don't, it's real nice because you don't have to be, you can be a playboy, you can still be a boy. You don't have to be a man. You don't have to be responsible. You don't have to make any decisions. You don't have to assume any responsibilities as over against her. You don't have to get involved or related. You don't have to know her name or give her your name. It's all on a trophy basis, you see, or a pet. And no demands are going to be made on you in this kind of a philosophy. And it's really interesting that the readership of Playboy, male readership of Playboy, drops sharply at age 31. Apparently by that time, some of the... By 31, man has matured and has accepted his wife as a good person to have around. Anyway, I think it's basically anti-feminine. If I were in women's lib, I'd really set up a campaign at this point. I think it's basically anti-personal, and I think it's anti-sexual, because it just doesn't understand the essence of sexuality. Because you see, sex is a way of discovery. Sex is a mystery. It's quite interesting when you go back, and here I'm borrowing Thielicke's insights, you go back to the story of Genesis, and what do you find? The whole business of creation and sexuality is pretty much buried in mystery. What does Adam know about women anyway? He was asleep when she came on the scene, you know. It's quite interesting. Any man that says he understands women is going counter to the scripture. There is here the suggestion, you see, that there are many things that we don't understand. And these old Hebrew stories about this have a great deal to say about relationships. And it talks about man and woman, you know, when they come together, they become one flesh. The Greeks have an old myth at this point, which says something like this, at one time or other, man and woman were two parts of the same entity, and somehow they got divided into two, and now they roam around the earth looking for one another, and when they find one another, once more then you have the completeness. You have the man hyphen woman. You have an entity. And this is almost reflects the Hebrew, the Hebrew concept at this point too. It's also very interesting to look at the word that the Hebrews use in scriptures for a sexual intercourse. It is the word no, or the English translation is no. Now this is not just an attempt to be delicate in language. Hebrews were not that at all. It's an attempt to express a real depth understanding of what this is when a man and a woman come together. But now the first thing that we understand when we become engaged in sexual, or when we enter into our sexual nature and sexual activity, is we discover something about ourselves. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? This is part of what we call the identity crisis in the life of a person as he grows up. You know, who am I? Shades of Salinger, the whole thing is there again. The confusion, the doubt, the self, the lack of self-understanding, the quizzing of the inner psyche. Who am I? What am I? What does it mean to be a person, a human being? And then finally, what does it mean to be only one half of the human race? And you see, this knowledge is given to a person in his first mature sexual experience. Part of the identity crisis is solved. At this point, a person understands what it is to be a man, or what it is to be a woman and not a man. There is a sense in which I believe it's Thielicke who says, a man owes a tremendous debt of gratitude to the woman who first shares her sexual life with him, if this is his first experience. Because she then is responsible for his finding out something about himself, something which he could not find out in any other way. This is an existential thing, and something which he will never find out again. From that moment on, the experience may be repeated many, many times, but not the element of it being the first experience. The illumination of his own being will never come again, because it has been given to him once, and he can't learn it again. The theologian Hamilton says, the first sexual act is so overwhelming in its significance, and so different from any other experience, that it is better reserved as a means of symbolizing and giving meaning to marriage. And what he's saying at this point is, this is such an overwhelming thing, it ought to be something that is experienced within the commitment of two people who are entering in upon their marriage together. As a symbol of the whole business of being man, being male, being female, and now being one flesh, as the scripture puts it. And then the Bible says, you know, the two became one. Derek Bailey, the Englishman who has written on sexual ethics and a number of other very, very fine things, uses, goes in at some depth in the meaning of this word, the two become one flesh. The Greek word is henosis. And he says this is something happens. Something happens to people when they enter in upon their sexual experience, this first one that brings a man and a woman aware of themselves, that is simply not repeatable, and it goes down into the very essence of life. And that's why he says this is not something that can be dealt with lightly. Two people, from that moment on, have gone through an experience which in essence makes it impossible to speak of them as separate individuals totally from then on. And then we discover something about another person. We discover the Hebrew word know. There's a continuation. And Adam knew his wife. And then again, and Adam knew his wife. And there is this idea that there is a continual knowledge which can be gained, you see, in this continuing relationship. I learned something about myself, but I also learned something about another person. And then a sexual intercourse can become a bond. You're dealing now with the depth of a relationship, not the variety of your relationship. It's something that ties two people together at the deepest levels of their being. The word prostitute has two dictionary definitions. One is to offer indiscriminately sexual intercourse, especially for money. And then the second one is to devote to corrupt or unworthy purposes. And there is a sense, you see, in which the first one is really just an example of the second one. Because one has taken something that was intended to be beautiful and meaningful to the extreme. Probably the most meaningful, or one of the most meaningful experiences that an individual can have in life. And this can become prostituted. That is, dragged down from this level to this level. And whether it's money or it's promiscuity or it's pleasure or whatever it may be, if it's less than the highest, there's something that's lost. Sexual intercourse is purposive. It's the sine qua non of marriage. We had a discussion this afternoon and we were talking about the possibility of marriage without sex. I don't think it's possible. I think it is that without which marriage does not exist. And both civil and ecclesiastical courts are in agreement at this point. If you can convince the court that you and your legal spouse have never consummated your marriage sexually, you can get an annulment of that marriage because it's not really a legal relationship. And the ecclesiastical courts, the church courts, will agree with you too. Marriage pretty much involves three things. It involves commitment, it involves ceremony, and it involves consummation. A commitment is the choice which two people make one of the other. It must be a mutual commitment, obviously. The consummation is when this relationship then is consummated sexually. And the ceremony is where the third parties enter in. The ceremony is where these people say to the world about them, we have chosen one another. We are, from this moment on, responsible for one another. And I mentioned just briefly what I'll touch on now. And I mentioned just briefly what I'll touch on now, and that is that when my own advice at this point, when people are either engaged in or are talking about sexual consummation without going through the ceremony, yet they feel they love one another, are in essence married, is that it does not give them the chance to protect one another and to really care for one another in the world about us. A person cannot be called into court to testify against his wife or husband. If you are simply engaged or you are engaging in sexual intercourse, this then would not be the case. You see, also man is sort of a weak creature. We need all the good offices of other people to keep us on the straight and narrow, to keep us living up to our best that we possibly can. For instance, what do you think would happen if there were two couples? This couple here was married, had committed themselves to one another, were publicly married in the presence of family and friends, made vows and so forth, and then this man went off to war. And over here you have a couple who are essentially moteling and have made no public declaration, but they still have some strong feelings for one another, are probably in love with one another, and are experiencing sex whenever they can. This man goes on to the war too. Now if these men were so injured by a destruction of the genitals or something of this sort, so that sexual union from that moment would be impossible, you know, which relationship would you expect to disintegrate faster? Now, I'm just tossing out an example, and maybe I'm saying, well, obviously the one, I guess maybe I am. I would expect that in general, the fact that people have publicly declared their fealty, their loyalty, have committed themselves to one another, that there would be some, there would be strength that would come from the fact that they have made these pledges. There would be support given in difficult times. There would be comfort that would lead them towards the possibility of obviously reestablishing the relationship on a different level with different concomitants, which would have to exclude at least sexual intercourse per se, but that there would be support given in this direction. I think a private declaration, it's much easier for people to forget simply because we are human beings. And I'm not throwing stones. I think I'm really just describing something about man as he was put together. What is it that's unique about marriage? Why shouldn't a person experience sex with a number of people? Why shouldn't you practice a bit? Remember the man who told me in one of my classes at Columbia that on his wedding night it was so much easier for his wife because he knew all there was to know about sex. And he could be helpful to her. What about the business of learning together a new experience? Otherwise it really gets to be, you see, that the village prostitute or the village easy girl becomes sort of a punching bag on which people practice. And then move into what they figure is a sound basic relationship. I have get that down. So Carol, I remember it at CLC at the college, being in the college union one day during a an alumni reunion, and I saw this couple down here, and I saw this couple down here, and they knew, and I knew from my counseling, that this guy had been to bed with this girl before he got there. And I really wondered, you know, how much genuine cordiality there might be around that alumni punch bowl. You know, what... what is unique about marriage? I was counseling with a girl the other day, and she said, or a couple of months ago, and she said, it seems to me, you know, your personalities and your interests and so forth, these are very important. And I said, they are. But what's qualitatively unique about that? She was, in essence, downgrading the sex as an essential component, or a very, very important component of marriage. And I said, it seems to me that that this is really something which is, if it's shared exclusively, is about the only thing that you can claim that is unique to your marriage. Because other experiences are pretty common. You may not, you know, eat the same mouthful and so forth as everybody else does, but everybody eats and so forth. But you have had an experience with this person, a personal experience, that that is not going to be duplicated. It's one area of your life which is exclusively yours. I don't believe that marriages are made in heaven. But I think that Filicky has some beautiful material when he says it isn't the idea that marriages are made in heaven ahead of time, but rather, he says, it is the fact that we are married that makes us alone for one another. Because we have had experiences together, we have suffered together, we have shared together, we have supported one another, we have reproduced our own selves in one another. We are committed to one another, and there is nobody else. And so he said, because we have this commitment, we pledge ourselves to one another, and there can be nobody else involved. And this is an exclusive bond, you see, that is made for me, and the sex expression is part of the reinforcement of the commitment. In a marriage relationship in which there is growth, in which there is this knowing of one another, sex becomes communication. It's very interesting that the word in Latin, the word intercourse, means to go between, to carry, to convey. It's the idea of people giving to one another something which is theirs and conveying it to the other person. Sex in a marriage becomes communication. Sex becomes forgiveness. Everything doesn't have to be beaten out in words, sometimes which are sharp. Things can be said with physical expression. Sex is renewal. It takes a relationship and it adds new dimensions to it. It takes the humdrum of the day. It does indeed ease the cares of the household. And sex is revelatory because it has a way of revealing new insights into our personality. Landis says that never before in our history has so much been put into marriage, you know, in terms of the load of expectation. It's almost impossible, you know, for people to achieve what we have loaded marriage with. You know, really, Cinderella's castle and happily ever after and all this is all caught up in this walk down the aisle. And he said, but he says it's not necessarily bad, it's just that our aspirations are so high that many people are going to be disappointed in this because they can't possibly achieve all that they want to achieve in marriage. It's also been pointed out that a great number of marriages which break up do not do so out of anger or hate or neurosis or this kind of thing. Sometimes they simply break up because people say, this marriage is not what it ought to be. I'm not getting anything out of this. Marriage is more than this. And so they will enter into a second marriage because they are exchanging a bad marriage for a good marriage. They feel there ought to be goodness in marriage and I'm not getting it. Therefore, they will end this one and seek happiness, fulfillment, and so forth in a second marriage. Let me read to you what I think is a very beautiful and helpful description of the place of sex in marriage. Evelyn Duvall is what you call she's a first-class sociologist in this place. She presents a pretty traditional line, but she does so having gone through the process of rethinking and has come out at this place again, which is just as valid as any new position or any new point of view, providing the thinking has been made. And she makes a distinction between romantic love and conjugal love. She says romantic love is the way marriages do begin and should begin, with people, 7 feet off the ground, cloud nine. I remember reading a description, James Peterson calls it cardiac respiratory love. Your breath comes, it's difficult to breathe, your heart pounds, you feel lightheaded, and you say, I'm in love. The doctor says, this is walking pneumonia. The symptoms are essentially the same. Now, it's not bad, you see, that marriage should get started on a real good binge of love. Strong sexual attraction, the works. C.S. Lewis says, really, the only thing that holds people together in marriage long enough for them to decide that they like one another and like being married is the pleasure of sex. And then, since this holds them together, draws them together and holds them together, then they decide, well, she's not so bad after all, in other ways. And so they decide to stick with it. But there is a difference then between the love with which you enter marriage. I'm not talking about infatuation. Infatuation is based on a lack of knowledge. Love is based on knowledge. But you love someone else, and so you enter into marriage. Then, says Duvall, you develop finally conjugal love, married love. Married love, you can't have it right away. You earn it. You work at it. You get it by doing things together. You have memories. You've lived together. You've suffered together. You have really found that there are some fine traits in this individual. And she says, this is conjugal love. Take a really satisfying day from the life of Fred and Mabel, who have been married long enough to have achieved a satisfactory sex adjustment. Fred comes home from a busy day at the plant full of the doings of his day. He tells Mabel about how grouchy the boss is, how green his new assistant is, how much progress he's making on his new machine, what he had for lunch, and what a funny duck he got talking to on the way home on the bus. This conversation takes up most of the dinner hour. It leaves Fred relaxed at having spilled the events of the day and gives Mabel the feeling that she had a part in those experiences. Mabel, too, has things to relate. She wants to share excerpts of the letter she has just received from her folks. She is eager to discuss with Fred what they will do with her mother when her father goes, and this letter tells of another heart attack, and they know there will be a final one. Although they don't really reach a final decision, Mabel senses that Fred is back of her. Whatever happens, and she feels a sudden burst of affection for her good old dependable Fred, right there while they are finishing dessert. She gets confidence to discuss that she has been running over her budget for the month, which they talk over with some heat. They end up with an understanding of the financial situation, and the atmosphere is cleared, leaving them both relieved. After supper, they do the dishes together. Fred drops and breaks the jelly dish. Mabel starts to fuss and then admits that she hated the thing anyway. They got it last Christmas from Aunt Harriet, whom she has always disliked. Fred grins and says he can't stand her either, as he kisses the back of her neck. She leans against him for a moment and observes that this is one thing she likes about him. They both dislike the same people. Aunt Harriet gets a going over by them both as they move into the living room. Fred puts on some records that they both enjoy and goes over his paper once more. Mabel sews in front of the fire. Clock strikes 10 as the symphony hour comes on. They are both tired but agree to stay up until the program is over. Mabel puts up her sewing, stretches out on the sofa. Fred drops his paper and comes over to sit beside her. As a favorite passage of music flows into the room, he squeezes her hand and smiles into her eyes. By bedtime, there has developed a strong sense of belonging to each other, a feeling of true unity. Sex intercourse then becomes not just a physical release, but a symbol of the whole relationship. Into it flow the meanings and the feeling tones of the broken jelly dish and the music and Fred's boss and Mabel's mother and all the security that has come from working it through together. Next morning, Fred gets up feeling like a million and leaves for work with a conviction that it would take a dozen bosses to get him down today. Mabel goes out to shop with a tune on her lips and in her mind a resolution to economize. Both face the new day with more poise, more peace, more strength and courage because the two are more than ever one. Into it goes, into the sexual act then goes, Fred's day, Mabel's mother, budget, Aunt Harriet, music. Fred's day again, Mabel understands, Mabel's mother is Fred's too. The budget will balance, fun to agree on pet hate. We must play our records more.
Well, there's one problem with that story. It's too tranquil. No kids to put to bed and all that stuff.
They haven't been married long enough to have kids, just long enough to have sex. Okay, what would you like to toss in, throw at me?
How binding is the commitment of that story you told about the gentleman coming home from war that was completely disabled?
Maybe the answer to your question will determine what happened. If the commitment is a commitment which is binding still upon both, then you will see a continuation of the relationship. In my book, and I don't mean this one, but in my mind, the heart of marriage is commitment. And if there is no commitment, there is no marriage. I don't care how much sex, how much pleasure, how much mutual this and that there may be, but there just is not what I think is the essence of marriage. I think it's the most deeply personal relationship in which two people can become involved. Kinsey says, for instance, our study of 6,000 marriages and 3,000 divorces has indicated that the strongest single element in keeping the marriage together is simply the will that it shall continue. Commitment. You know, people say, come hell or high water, there's only one woman for me. So there's no point in my looking at the secretary or dreaming about the neighbors or something. I can't afford to expend the energies needed to heal this marriage by daydreaming or flitting around or going through the Felix cause called, you know, the process of comparison. By the time you have compared your spouse with the next one, and then the next one that comes along before that is over, you know, he says it's enough to drive you crazy. All the energies and the strengths and the insights and the love that you have have got to go towards the healing, the strengthening, or the building and the catapulting of this relationship to where it should be.
If we're taking commitment then in that, and using that as a key point here, and to pick up on that, then that that you were saying that sexuality and intercourse becomes the high point of a marriage, or in a sense the high point of that kind of commitment. Maybe I'm linking to the statement that you won't allow a linking. In that context, if you will allow that linkage, would you comment on the perhaps the changing nature of commitment with contraception as another option, and without the commitment to childbirth, and does that change the position of sexuality and intercourse?
No, I think the race needs sexual intercourse to continue, if the race is to continue. Marriages, by and large, need the same, because this is where the intercourse takes place, where the children, where the race is born. But I do not feel that one must then go to the next step and say, therefore, every single marriage must have a commitment to child rearing. Maybe I'll just stop there.
My question was, commitment to what exactly? To the institution of marriage, to each other, to family?
To a person. Always to a person. You're never committed, for instance, to a function. Otherwise, as soon as the function can be better carried out by someone else has more money, this man earns more money, this person is more sexually attractive, this person would bake apple pie better, you know, then you discard this. But if you're committed always to a person.
What qualities in the person to whom you're committed, or what qualities in yourself, you know, are necessary? Something, this commitment seems to be getting lower and lower and lower in our American system all the time, I believe. Does commitment come, the ability to be committed, come with maturity, or to what characteristics is commitment most validly, you know, toward or in the self, or what? I don't understand.
I think that would be individual taste, an individual makeup. You can have people who are neurotic to the point where they're both out of balance, but it's the fact that they're out of balance in complementarity with one another that makes this maybe a very, very strong marriage. So what would drive someone crazy, it may be just what the other person psychologically needs.
I think too that commitment.
Yeah, wait, I've left her with a puzzled look.
Yeah, my ability to really understand commitment is limited, evidently. I can't see what, you know, I don't understand what will actually make commitment last and last and last.
Can I speak to that? I keep hearing something here that I've been hearing earlier today, and that is that we are almost demanding that commitment to one person fulfill our needs. And I get hung up with that. I don't think any one person can fulfill, that I can be committed to any one person enough to fulfill my needs completely. And that's what I hear us saying. That's what I hear you saying, that we are in this marriage relationship, we are fulfilled. And I don't think there is any one person who can fulfill all my needs.
Well, we haven't been talking about a good marriage yet, you know. We've been talking about what is the essence of being married. So the essence is the commitment and the sex and possibly the ceremony. Now, what is a good marriage? I think there's where you begin to love lots of people, and there are lots of these ingredients that come in from the outside. Because I agree with you absolutely.
I guess that's what's coloring the commitment business, you know, why it's difficult to pin down the commitment thing.
Well, at this point, we have blinders on, and we are trying to focus down on one point. Go ahead, you and then over here.
I would like to know, you have linked commitment and responsibility. Chris Pearl says, I'm not in this world to live up to your expectations, and you are not here to live up to my expectations. This has been used by people to say, well, if you have a problem with me coming home late for dinner, you know, why do you expect me to live up to your expectations? Would you care to, you know, in what way are we responsible for each other? Is it the role that we have agreed to play, or is it we are responsible for each other's, the building up of each other's feelings, or not? And, you know, in what way would you comment on that Pearl statement, too?
I think you may have put your finger on it, speak of role. Some people are going to devise methods of living with one another that would drive me up the wall. Yet this is something that satisfies them. They have a right to their own lifestyle, their own life, their marital lifestyle. I would question, you know, just as an observer, the quality of love. In a kind of a relationship which says, well, Toots, I'm really not concerned about how you feel. Because I'm sure some of this is colored by my Christian concept of being a servant and being concerned for others. But the whole idea of entering into this is the self, yes, but also the selflessness that I wish to give to another person. I wish to make that person a whole person. I wish to protect that person and to bring that person to flower, whatever it may be. Sometime next week, early part of the week, we'll try and get into the matter of role. And of course, now, this could be a real warm one. When you talk about masculine roles and feminine roles today. But there's a lot that comes back to Ephesians 5 there. You know, how is a man supposed to love his wife? He's supposed to love her as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her. There's a little story which is one step over, but it's the story of the women at a coffee clutch who were talking about what they would do if their houses caught on fire. You know, would they rescue their husbands or their children? And they were really concerned. They didn't know quite what they would do. A number of them. One woman was very sure. She said, well, I would rescue the children. I said, why? And she said, well, simple, I'm related to that. Now, when we enter into marriage, we are related. We relate ourselves. We make commitments. Actually, if it came down to the nitty-gritty of life, if a man who has made these vows from a Christian point of view were in a position where it was his life or his wife's, he has no choice. He's committed. If he's going to be faithful to his commitment, he is to love his wife as Christ loved the church and he gave. Now that doesn't clarify, but it may push it a little further.
Yes,
what you're saying is really, there has to be a lot of the grace of God supporting any kind of a relationship and willing to commit yourself together to do this. Then you know, it's really a lot easier to do this if you say, well, we will help one another. And that's part of what's involved in at least the religious ceremony. We will do this together in the community, helping one another. Well, thank you.